doing basics of a rather different kind with Peter Hobson. Peter, you combine three disciplines in your work as a research scientist in psychopathology, also a psychiatrist and a therapist as well. And you've now written The Cradle of Thought, which is a refreshingly accessible and highly readable book on the origins of thinking. And your starting point is that we think in a way that automatically distinguishes us from even the highest form of animals and certainly from computers, even the most advanced we could possibly think of. Just tell us what that distinction is. How is the four of us, or five of us sitting around this table, fundamentally different from what computers might do?
Okay, well, if you get chimpanzees first, I mean, it's just worth noting that our intellectual...
Maybe not that different, that's the point.
Well, no, I don't know. Our intellectual and cultural life is very different from that of chimpanzees, even though we're closely related. And the question is why, and I think the answer is it has a lot to do with the fact that we have a special means to think, kind of tools of thought, and specifically that we can symbolise. That we can ground meanings most impressively in language, in the sounds that we utter, so our spoken words, or the scribbles that we write. And by virtue of that ability, we have all kinds of new intellectual powers that otherwise we wouldn't.
And the other thing is we're aware of what we're doing, which is...
We're aware of what we're doing. I mean, I think in order to kind of frame a picture, so we can kind of understand how this develops. Let's just take a humdrum example. Here we are in Broadcasting House sitting around a table, and that can serve as a kind of focus. And what we can do is to choose to move through a kind of mental space, taking up one perspective and then another about the table. So we can think it has a hard surface that we can lean on, the BBC must have spent an awful lot of money on it because it's such a fine table, and so on.
You can think all kinds of different things about the same thing.
Indeed, and that you know that what you're doing in that is moving in thought from perspective to perspective. So if I have a thought about banging my fist on the table to make a point, so far, anyway, it's just a thought. And that seems to suggest that maybe the story about the development of thinking is bound up with another story, which is the story of the development of a certain human kind of self-awareness, because I'm conscious of my own conscious activity.
Because the heart of your book's argument, it seems to me, is this notion that we pick up this skill of thinking through interaction with other human beings. And that's a sort of huge point in a way. But
yeah.
How does that happen, and how early does it happen that a little baby picks up the notion of thinking from seeing other people around them? Talk us through that.
Well, there's two planks, in a way, the account. One is an evolutionary one, and one has to do with human babies. And the evolutionary bit presents something of a conundrum, because evolution is a process that occurs in small steps over long periods of time. And what we have here is not a small step, but a mighty leap into our intellectual life that's happened in a very short space of evolutionary time. 2 million years, probably largely in the last 250,000. How can that be? And maybe the key to that issue is to look to human babies. How do human babies build upon the foundations that they're given by genes and biology in the context of the environment that they're provided with, in order then, by the age of about 18, 20 months, to have this special kind of thinking, because the 20-month-old can symbolically play, leaps up into language, and can understand perspectives.
And your answers are that they can get this from very early interactions, even as early as an hour into their life. You say that there's some kind of reaction.
There's some kind of linkage, yes. And I think the evolutionary trick is quite simple, is to deepen and strengthen the emotional engagement between one person and another. That was the trick. And that seems a bit bizarre, because we're trying to explain thinking, and I'm talking about feelings, and we're trying to explain what happens in the individual's head, as it were, and I'm talking about what happens between individuals. But yes, I think you're right. I think that human beings are set up to become engaged, and the critical thing, if we go to human infancy, let's leap over the first 9 months, because we haven't got time for it, that's very important. But at the end of the first year, you see things in human babies that you don't see in chimpanzees, you don't see in children with autism, and you don't see, and present particular difficulties for children who are congenitally blind. And that's important for the argument. And what you see is that, a 12-month-old shares experiences of the world with other people. So, for instance, if we have a mother and daughter, the child might bring things to present to her mother, offer things, give things, notice the mother's reaction to the world, follow the mother's eye gaze out into the world, begin to point herself. And there's something called social referencing, which is particularly interesting. Supposing our 12-month-old's been given a toy duck for her first birthday, which makes a funny electronic quack. That child is interested, but also wary. And what she's likely to do is to look to her parent and see her parent's reaction to that duck, and the meaning of that toy alters in accordance with the attitude shown by her parent. So she's moved in attitude to find new meaning in that object.
And partly by discovering that other people see things other ways, discovers that there are different opinions, and that
absolutely
is part
right
of the heart of thinking. But one of the things, I think the proof, that, if you like, that's going to be very arresting for people, is you cite what happens when people do not have, babies do not have, that other human interaction.
Yep.
Children who, for whatever reason, and we'll move on to the autism thing in a moment, but whatever reason, do not have other human interaction. Just give us a very specific example of that, because I think it's quite powerful.
Other than autism, you mean?
Yeah, I think...
Yeah. Well, I mean, recently what's come to light is the developmental implications of the terrible privation that people, that children, young children suffered in the orphanages of Romania. And what's startled investigators is that the prevalence of autism, of a constellation of difficulties, both in social relations and in thinking, is higher in this group of individuals who really have encountered almost no, and I emphasize that, almost no human engagement of the kind we're interested in. And the point of the story is that the engagement at first happens automatically, and it's only later you come to understanding. And if you haven't got even the basics of engagement, then you put at an enormous disadvantage in this perspective taking and the understanding of
almost as if you can not actually learn to think if you're denied that kind of emotional reaction. You mentioned autism. It's obviously hugely in the news at the moment because of this fear that it's somehow linked to the MMR jab. But you suggest, or the logic of what you're arguing suggests there might be another explanation for this large rise. And it could be, the logic of what you're saying is surely that if a child is denied that kind of emotional interaction, that could create or lead to some kind of autism.
No, I've got to be quite clear. No, I do not think that autism is caused by, in the normal course of events, unless it's really extreme, it's caused by bad parenting or a lack of input. I simply don't believe that. But what is important is I do think that autism is a syndrome, a constellation of clinical features, which include these difficulties engaging emotionally and difficulties with language and communication and difficulties with thinking in a flexible way. And the important thing is that if those abilities arise through a kind of system of child in relation to other people, there may be a number of things in the child that cause some kind of difficulty with that engagement. And I believe in the large majority of cases of autism, there is something, you know, their brains aren't working right from really very early on, such that they can't make use, they can't benefit from the engagement that they're offered.
Elaine Showalter, this seems to me, intellectually anyway, a kind of vindicational victory for what much of feminism was arguing, because there's an emphasis here on emotional intelligence, mm-hmm. in a way, rather than just the sort of old brain mechanics. And this is something that surely the women's movement was drawing our attention to 20, 30 more years ago.
Yes, but on the other hand, I mean, I think it's a complex situation, because I think that there is the troubling implication of some of Phillips' studies that autism is created situationally, and although I mean I understand the situation where you don't want to blame the parents or make the parents feel worse, but on the other hand, if you say that autism is more common among Romanian orphans, or in one of the studies that you do that among blind children, that there are situational factors that make human interaction more difficult and they lead to more autism, surely this has got to make parents, and particularly mothers who take the burden of the guilt for child care, feel that they've done something wrong with the child. That seems to me ultimately the problem with this kind of study, that when you're talking about behavior and not causes.
No, it's not the problem of the studies. It's the problem of what you might infer wrongly from those studies. I do not think in the normal way of things differences in mothering or fathering are what causes autism. But I do believe that in order to develop these capacities for thinking, certain very basic conditions have to be in place in terms of becoming emotionally engaged. In fact, you need very little input, very little, in order to be able to have enough to develop this whole perspective-taking story. So I don't believe, I'm certainly not in any way blaming mothers or anyone else for causing the autism, but you do have to understand for development to take place, there need to be human contact, human engagement, and the other things that I've been emphasising.
Do you have a position on MMR?
No.
All right, because that is very much another debate completely. Malcolm Rifkin, one of the things that Pete Hobson broadens out onto is the whole connection between thought and language. And it is a familiar debate in philosophy anyway. Can you even speak about a thought or think about a thought if you don't have the language for it. In your own field of politics, I mean, how much of an effect does it have on our political conversation, the kind of language we use?
Oh, I think the strength of a political success is not just what you say, but how you say it, the ability to communicate, and language is all important in that. I was intrigued. I was able to read Peter Hobson's book, which you kindly sent me a copy of, and as I understand it, he's arguing that language and thought are not innate. They are a consequence of very early social relationships with parents and with other people. The question I wanted to ask him is, well, what about a child who tragically is both deaf and blind, but in other respects, you know, is well-loved and well-cared for? Obviously, such a child would have great difficulties in learning speech, but what about thought? Is thought possible, given that thought is normally articulated in language? How does that
briefly
affect such a child?
I just think it's very difficult. I mean, I think that if you go, even just congenitally blind children, if you go to school for blind children, as I have, one is struck both by the fact that many can develop and get through it, but many are severely have severe difficulties in creative play, in their symbolic thinking. Now, there are other ways round that than through vision, and the challenge would be to find ways of linking in such a way that this can take place, this perspective taking.
All right, and we obviously could talk about that for much longer, but let's turn to Elaine Scholz, a professor of English at Princeton University, and you now spend much of your time here in Britain as a critic and writer.